Just a reminder for those listening on the internet to fill out the survey. I'll post the survey again on the link this time. Thank God we've had good response, but the more the merrier. Okay. We concluded last time, this is really one of the few classes that we're going to do that are two-parter. So each one stands alone on its own, but this, I think the recap of last time is more important for this one. So just to very briefly recap, and then everyone will be up to speed, what we saw last time is that the chain of sort of rabbinic leadership, rabbinic leadership, which is, speaking of rabbinic leadership, the chain of leadership that is posited for rabbinic leadership, and by that I mean the notion that this represents the leadership that the rabbis maintained for all of Jewish society. So that sort of view of the rabbis as leaders of the people and this particular group of people as leaders of the rabbis is as follows. I've given you sort of part of the chain at the very top of the sheet, although it's abbreviated. Last week, the chain that we had went from Hillel the elder, Hillel HaZaken, all the way down to Rabbi Gamliel the sixth, who's at the very end of this list. And the list gave us a series of figures who were supposed to have held the position of Nasi, of patriarch. We saw from Origen's letter to Africanus that by the 4th century, the patriarch, the Nasi, had a great deal of power, whether his powers were quite as broad and sweeping as Origen insists is questionable, but at the very least, to a statement like Origen's, they must have been extensive. What we saw was that, in fact, there is an unaccounted-for gap between the first person post-destruction of the temple who held the title Nasi, which is Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, and the last person before the destruction of the temple to hold the title Nasi, who was presumably Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel the first. There's a gap between those two figures of 100, 200 years of people to whom, in at least in sources from Eretz Yisrael, the Talmud Bavli we saw is a different story, don't have the title Nasi attributed to them, even though they're supposed to have been part of this family, this family that passes down the title Nasi from father to son. We also noted that if we are to take seriously a list of figures who passed down the title Nasi father to son, beginning with Hillel, all the way down to Rabbi Gamliel the sixth, versions of which can be found already in the Gaonim, which were popularized by the sort of 19th century German Jewish historians. If we were to take seriously such a list, it would be the longest list in world history of uninterrupted patrilineal descent or patrilineal passing down of one leader to another, something that we thought was not impossible or unlikely, but at least something that should give us pause. When we examined our sources critically, is that in fact the institution of Nasi, a patriarch, prior to the destruction of the Second Temple, was not a leadership position in the way that Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi held it, which is to say he didn't have civil authority, wasn't an aristocrat, didn't interface with government officials, or that sort of thing. Didn't hold sort of a gubernatorial position, if you will. But in fact, it simply denoted the person who was the chief of the Sanhedrin, or at least would ideally be the chief of the Sanhedrin in the view of Chazal. And so, in fact, we saw even more reason to posit some sort of discontinuity between Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi and those who came before him. And then finally, when we examined all of the sources that we could find in the Bavli, of course, because there are none in Eretz Yisrael that link Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi explicitly to those who came before him. And just the preface, one of the arguments for the notion that Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi is just sort of one person in a long line of Nasiim that predate him, that argument depends on the idea that Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi is descended from the house of Rabbi Gamliel, and that his father is Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel the second. So we showed that there's actually no source from Eretz Yisrael that ever makes that claim. They're all the sources that make those claims are in the Bavli, And we saw that when you examine the sources that are parallel to those sources, in sources from Eretz Yisrael, in fact, none of them make that claim. This is a claim that is first made by the Bavli. And we argued that the reason for that is because, although the Bavli may know, like the sources from Eretz Yisrael, that Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi is not in fact descended from the house of Rabbi Gamliel, nonetheless, the Bavli is trying to teach us the importance of each generation aspiring to add to that link, to add to that chain of great leaders that arise in every generation. Even if it's from a statistical standpoint, each generation producing a superlative leader is unlikely, highly unlikely from an economic standpoint. David Hume already made this point in one of his treatises on the progress of the arts and sciences. We, nonetheless, guided by the Bavli, aspire to excellence in every single generation. Okay, so that was the case that we made. So to sum up in one sentence, what we learned last time is that Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, Rabbi Judah the Prince, to whom is attributed, probably rightly, the editing of the Mishnah, Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi was the first of the people who would hold the title Nasi, or patriarchs. He was the first sort of aristocratic leader of the Jewish people, mixing sort of a civil authority with also a theological religious authority. Now, yes?
Just as an aside, so we always say he edited the Mishnah. Mm-hmm. When was it actually put to papyrus or text?
Was the Mishnah, like in other words, was the Mishnah ever written down as such? So good question.
Rambam says like 800,000 years later.
Right. So the Rambam, right? In other words, the Rambam sees the impetus for writing down what he took to be a bunch of things that had been preserved in oral tradition from all the way from Har Sinai, or at least for a very long time. There are very few things, in fact, that the Rambam thinks actually originated at Sinai. The things that the Rambam thinks really originated at Sinai were things were matters over which there were no machlokos. There are no disputes, in other words, things that were just unquestioned. As well, it seems, the Rambam thought that the hermeneutical principles by which laws are derived from the Torah were also handed down from Moshe. It's just the question of how to apply those rules is a matter of dispute. But in terms of what the Rambam thinks is the history of the Mishnah, so the Rambam argues that, in fact, served as the impetus to reduce the Mishnah or the oral traditions that he thought comprised the Mishnah to writing was sort of a political crisis that prompted Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi to figure that all of these things would be forgotten unless they were written down. Unless that occurs, sort of to ensure that these things would not be forgotten, this great project of writing down Torah Sheba'al Peh came to be. Why the Rambam lays out this view of history and sort of what his rhetorical goals are is an interesting question. As a matter of history, we stand on the shoulders of giants. We happen to know things about history from archaeology or from other sources that the Rambam, had he known them, of course, would have made far better use of them than we could possibly. But we happen to know them. The Rambam did not. We know that, in fact, the time in which Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi lived was really a high point of political relations with the Roman Empire. It's sort of in the throes of the Pax Romana. So it doesn't seem that political crisis was the impetus for the writing down of the Mishnah. What exactly was the impetus? Hopefully we'll... what we mean when we say that the Mishnah was edited is another question entirely. The Mishnah is interesting because it seems to be composed of sources that probably were passed down orally and some other sources that give indication they were passed down in writing, and Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi sort of integrated them. Some sources from Chazal talk about Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi using the notebooks of his predecessors, like Rabbi Meir, and so on and so forth, to sort of draw from. So there may have been some writing involved. What those processes are, hopefully in a later class we're going to get to them. But good question. Right now, what I'd like to do is basically ask the following question. If it's true that Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi is the first of the patriarchs, so sort of the first in what would be, if you look at the chart at the top here, these are his descendants, what would be sort of a relatively long line, even if it's not as simple as this list makes it out, but what would be a quite a long line of leaders of the Jewish people. So if he was really the first, so we really have to ask ourselves, where did he come from? Where did Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi come from? As we saw last week, his father, at least according to the sources from Eretz Yisrael, doesn't seem to have been a very distinguished person, at least rabbinically speaking. So we have to ask ourselves, where did Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi come from? Where did the practices or trappings that ended up comprising the role of Nasi, where did they come from and what were they? What was unique about the position Nasi that hadn't existed before and that characterized it going forward? And then finally, we have to ask ourselves, what does it tell us about the history of Jewish leadership moving forward over the course of the height of the rabbinic period? What does it tell us that the type of leadership that ended up coalescing was this particular type of leadership that we're going to investigate? In other words, what can we learn about the rabbinic period, about rabbinic Judaism, about rabbis in particular, and about, most importantly, our modern Orthodox community, and in particular its iteration here on the Upper West Side? What can we learn about ourselves from this investigation? So now, what we're going to do...
All these people lived exclusively in Israel.
Yes, they all seem to have lived exclusively in the land of Israel. But Mr. Blank is asking a question the answer to which we can even use to refine even more the question even more, which is to say, where did these people live? Where did Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi live? So where in Israel did he live? So has anyone ever been to the grave of Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi?
Up north,
right? Where is it? We actually saw it two classes ago. Right, so Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi seems to have frequented Tzipori. He's not buried in Tzipori, though, but that is a good guess, because that's one of the major cities of the Galil, which is the region with which Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi is most frequently, really always associated. It is in a place called Beit Sha'arim. If you remember, two classes ago we examined the catacombs, some of the graves of the archaeological remains from Beit Sha'arim, some of which mention rabbis. One of the catacombs there, catacomb 20, although it could be catacomb 16. One of the catacombs, one of the major catacombs. Just why I want to get it, I don't want to get complaints afterwards. Whichever one it is, one of the catacombs houses graves that seem to bear the names of people who are identified as rabbis, bear the names like Gamliel and Shimon, that we know were members of Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi's family. And then there's one unmarked but very lavish grave that's been identified, I think reasonably, as the grave of Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi. But in any event, and I think I've given a picture, that picture on top is the entrance to that particular catacomb. So in any event, what we know about these figures is not just that they lived in Israel, but that they lived in a particular part of Israel, which is to say, the Galil. They lived to the north. Now, where would you have expected, in an ideal world...
Yerushalayim.
Excellent, right, that was my question. Where would you have expected Jewish leaders to be? Yerushalayim. Why were they not in Yerushalayim? It was... It was attacked, right? Judenrein, right.
It was leveled.
It was leveled. It was burnt down. When was it? And we actually spent, I think, a couple semesters ago. We spent a couple of classes dealing with this. What happened to precipitate the clearing out of Yerushalayim and the leveling of many of the structures there? What major event occurred? The Bar Kokhba revolt, exactly. Between the years 132 to 135 CE, the Bar Kokhba revolt rages under the reign of the Emperor Hadrian. Hadrian, vindictive. Really, from our perspective, villain that he was, cleared out the city of Yerushalayim, transformed it into the military colony called Aelia Capitolina, and as the narrative goes, sort of this is the old school Jewish historian narrative. As the narrative goes, the Jewish people, sort of, especially the rabbinic leadership, picked up from Judea, from Yehuda, from sort of the southern part of Eretz Israel, and they migrated north to the Galil. So there was this massive population transfer that occurs in the wake of the Bar Kokhba revolt, sort of about the middle of the second century of the Common Era, and that is why, in the generations after that, you begin to see all of your major rabbinic figures in the north. So to give you an example, a compatriot, or a colleague of Rabbi Akiva, who was part of the generation of the Bar Kokhba revolt, is named Rabbi Yossi Haglili, exactly, Hagalili, right? He's Rabbi Yossi from the Galilee. Now, why would it make sense to call someone the Galilean, right? Rabbi Yossi the Galilean, as opposed to Rabbi Yossi, why didn't they call Rabbi Akiva HaYehudi, Rabbi Akiva the Judean? Because everyone was from Judea. It was weird that there was somebody from the Galilee amongst all of these Judean scholars. In the generation after that, why don't we call Rabbi Yossi bar Chalafta? Why don't we call Rabbi Yehuda bar Eloi? Why don't we call Rabbi Meir Hagalili? Because everyone was from the Galilee, right? Everyone was in the Galilee. So there is definitely this generational shift in between the generation of Rabbi Akiva and the generation, let's say, of the next scholars who would be Rabbi Yossi, Rabbi Yehuda, Rabbi Meir, and Rabbi Yonatan, Rabbi Yoshiah, and so forth. So there is this shift. But is it true? This we have to ask ourselves. Is it true that there is this major population transfer from Judea and the Galilee? And question 1A would be, how can we tell? How would we know?
The Bar Kokhba revolt, didn't they basically force a lot of the Jews out of Israel into Rome, and they sold them off as slaves, those that they killed?
Right.
So we had a small population up north. It's not, when you say mass migration, that the whole community left. I mean, you had hundreds of thousands of people killed.
Right.
And you have hundreds of thousands of people sold into slavery. So we're talking to...
Right, know, so that...
And did they, you know, was it a mass migration? Did they escape
there? The just like the numbers.
The point, the point is a good one, which is to say... lots of things could have happened in the wake of the Bar Kokhba revolt, right? Now, it happens to be that we have a paucity of contemporaneous sources here. We don't have any very good information on what happened to Jews after the Bar Kokhba revolt, where they went. Later traditions do develop that in fact they were deported, many of them sold in Rome as slaves. Undoubtedly that happened. But the question is, to what degree, how many, it's hard to know. The working assumption that people have maintained, historians maintained for a long time, is that really most people would have gone, in other words, it wasn't as if there was this sort of mass slaughter of Jews. I'm sure many Jews certainly were killed, but since we start to see all of these rabbinic figures suddenly appear in the north, in the wake of the Bar Kokhba revolt, so maybe most people didn't just leave Israel, they moved up north. So that at least is the work, but in other words, that's a good point, and that's actually going to drive our investigation. What happened in the wake of the Bar Kokhba revolt? So here's question number two. How would we know? How can we test this? The hypothesis is the Galilee explodes, right? The population, there's a population explosion in the Galilee in like the middle of the second to the early third century of the Common Era. That's the hypothesis. How do we test it?
Burial areas.
So Mrs. Deegan already is pointing us to archaeology, which I think is exactly where we need to be, right? Let's look. What are some of the population indicators of an expanding population? So the answer is we go to the archaeological record, right? We can look for sites that appear in the Galilee in this period of time, and we can ask ourselves, do they get bigger? Do they get smaller? Are there more bodies? Are there fewer bodies? That sort of things. So take a look at source number two. Source number two I've given you here, a settlement map of the Galilee in the relevant time period. Now, this site, although any map like this, which is going to give you all the settlements that are in the Galilee over the course of a given time period, it's going to be too brief a snapshot, or it's going to include too many places. So this is as best as we can approximate. So all of these black dots, squares, circles, octagons, these are all the settlements that we've uncovered from the time period that we're discussing in the Galilee. Now, there are a lot of them, right? There are a lot of them. Now, if you'll notice, there are red arrows next to four sites. The one labeled number 21 all the way to the side over here is Luzia. The one labeled number 22 all the way to the right is Livnim. And then all the way up top, the one pointing to number one is Samu'ia. And the one, there's like a little red dot. Actually, I have to make it because it's very small. A little bit to the southeast of number 14, that is Kahal. Now, those four sites that I've just pointed to you with those arrows, are the only four sites in this time period that undergo expansion. The only four. Other sites in the Galil, and you can see a dozen, if not more, on this map, are unaffected. Some of them even shrink. And in fact, of these four sites that I've given you, two of them already existed in the early Roman period. So it's not like they're new. So of these four sites, two of them are new sites, and the other two that expand are old sites that are just growing a little bit. So if we were really expecting this, if we were really sort of witnessing here this massive population transfer from the south to the north, to have this little expansion, so few new cities built, would be odd. In fact, it seems that there was no population transfer, right? This map at least would indicate that there wasn't a population transfer. Moreover, we don't even have to rely only on archaeology. Take a look to the right. This source is from Shir HaShirim Rabbah. It's a little bit of a late midrash, but it will suffice for our purposes. So this source characterizes the period in the aftermath of the Bar Kokhba revolt when, according to the narrative depicted in this midrash, the rabbinic leadership is sort of regrouping in the wake of a terrible tragedy, in the wake of the terrible tragedy of the Bar Kokhba revolt. And here's what the source says. B'shofa yashmad, niskansu rabo seno lo'osha. So in the aftermath of the persecution of the Bar Kokhba revolt, the rabbis gathered in Usha. Usha is a town in the Galil, which according to Chazal, is where sort of the rabbinic center moves after the Bar Kokhba revolt. Shalchu Eitzel Zikni HaGalil, V'amr Komishu Shulamud, rather, Yavav Yilamid, V'komishu Ein Alamud, Yavav Yilmud. Niskantov Lamdu, Velsakot Zarkeon, Kamen Shigiru Zmanam Lihipater, Amru Makam Shineskabalmu Basocho, Anumanichim Osam Rekam, Chalku Kavod L'Rabbi Huda Shahaya Ben Ir. Okay, so what happened is, in the wake of the Bar Kokhba revolt, so they're convening an RCA convention, right? Everyone's going to get together, they're going to come to Usha, there's going to be a resort there, they'll have a 24-hour tea room, and in the meantime, we're all going to work out the rabbinic politics of the next generation. Okay, so everyone comes. Now, the people who are organizing this are called the Ziknei HaGalil, the Elders of the Galilee. Right, so already, it doesn't seem as if this convention is being organized.
The Ziknei HaGalil aren't organized.
They're being invited. Okay, right. So you can read it that way also. In other words, the Ziknei HaGalil are the invitees. The people who are organizing it are so far unnamed. Right. You could read that. Right. That's certainly a valid way to read this also. Now, and we're told anybody who is learned. Anyone who is learned, come and teach. And anyone who is not learned, you can come and learn. Now, what can we take away from that line about the population of the Galil?
They're literary.
They're literate. They know how to, and not just that they know how to read, like in a functional sense, they know how to learn.
Yeah.
Right? So it's not as if we should argue that sort of there's no rabbinic presence in the Galil and they're all being imported from Yehuda. Right? There are people here who certainly know how to learn.
This is almost a political issue. New Rebbe in town takes congregants away from the existing
politics. So maybe there's shul politics here, right? So, and that leads into the next bit that we read, which is that as soon as the time came for everybody to leave, they said, "We have left empty the place that has hosted us." So in other words, they didn't want to leave the Galil, or in particular where they were in the Galil, without praising their host. So what did they do? They honored Rabbi Yehuda Bar Ilai, who was a native of the city. Okay, so there's a major figure of this new generation of rabbis, Rabbi Yehuda of the Mishnah, as in Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Shimon, of great fame. He is identified here as a native of the Galil. Okay, so we have elders in the Galil, we have learned people in the Galil, we have a major figure of this generation right after the Bar Kokhba revolt, who is identified as a native of the Galil. And what does he say? He says to all of the gathered people, "V'atem achenu rabosenu gedolei haTorah, Mishan etzta'er bachem asaramil o esrim o shloshim or arba'im kedei lishmo divrei Torah al achas kam v'kama shen akadosh baruch mekabeach scharchem bazeh abava. Okay. So he says, and you, our brethren, giants of Torah, those among you who have troubled yourselves to travel 10, 20, 30, or even 40 mil in order to hear words of Torah, certainly God will not now or in the future reward you any less, as the Midrash goes on to explain, than the Jews who traveled to study with Moshe, they walked less than that. Okay. What does Rabbi Yehuda say? Rabbi Yehuda says, the people who are gathered here have traveled great distances to be here at this major convention in the wake of the Bar Kokhba revolt. From how far away have they come? So, if the Judean population, the Judea to Galil population transfer theory is correct, so they, right, we would assume they would come from Yerushalayim, or at the very least, pick the northernmost point in Yehuda and say they've all come from there, right? They've come from somewhere just to the south of the Galil, even if we're going to be very conservative. Maybe as Dr. Schwartzman is suggesting, right? So the Rabbi Yehuda Bar Ilai is sort of praising people who have come not just from just south of Galil, maybe from major rabbinic centers in Yehuda, right? Bnei Brak, maybe Yavne, places like that. Okay. Here's the problem. How far is the farthest that Rabbi Yehuda can imagine people traveled to get to this RCA convention? 40 mil. How far is Yehuda from the Galil? Much further. 100 mil. 100 mil. So here, Rabbi Yehuda, in characterizing the great personal sacrifice that attendees of this convention undertook to get there. So the farthest that they've traveled. Yeah, right. Netanya, right? They've come from somewhere close by. So this great ingathering of rabbinic talent in the wake of the Bar Kokhba revolt is characterized here as local. As local. So it doesn't seem from the sources that we've examined so far that there's a population transfer. It's not as if all the rabbinic talent is in the south, and then it moves to the north. So essentially what we have documented in the Mishnah, when we have sort of earlier scholars from Yehuda and later members of Chazal from the Galil, it's not as if we should, in a certain respect, we should of course expect continuity between the two. That's how our tradition, that's how Masorah works. But it's not as if we should expect the same cast of characters to appear, and perhaps maybe we should expect there should be some differences that should filter in with the new cultural and geographical milieu. Maybe not, but maybe we should be open to that possibility. Yes.
Is it possible that the rabbinic sources in the south have been destroyed, and the north was not affected by the Bar Kokhba revolt? Those communities stayed intact, and the southern communities were either destroyed, deported, and some of them may have migrated north, but it's basically
right.
These are the rabbis who are already there. 40 years later, they reconstitute.
Right. Excellent question. Excellent question. In fact, the Yerushalmi, when it refers to communities of people who are either themselves rabbinic or associated, or at least are interested in hearing the opinions of rabbis, so some of them are people like Tibera'a, the members of Tiberias, the people from Tiberias, Tziporah, the people from Sepphoris, these are all from Tzipori, these are all big cities in the Galil. One such group of people are the Droma'a, the southerners, right? These are people probably from Lud, right? People from Lida in the south. So in other words, we know that there are people who are either rabbis or interested in connecting with rabbis who live in the south. And it is possible that they maintain sort of sources that didn't make it into the final product of the Yerushalmi, let's say. But certainly by a certain period, or like a couple, by a generation or two, let's say, after the Bar Kokhba revolt, certainly if there was sort of this thriving rabbinic culture in the south, it would have had plenty of time to recover and produce literature. So the fact that we don't have it doesn't mean that it doesn't exist. But it would be hard to imagine that we could blame the Bar Kokhba revolt for that. But it is an excellent point in terms of pointing out that there is a presence that is in the south. It's just not the main presence. But right, excellent point. Yes.
I'm looking at the dates. You're dealing with a source that that's coming 300 years or so after
true.
The archaeological evidence.
True.
So, you know, what I'm wondering is, at that point, 40 miles, 100 miles, those kinds of things become a little bit convoluted over time.
That's correct. That is correct. So Shir HaShirim Rabba is, and in fact, many of her Haggadic sources, meaning there are some of them that are like medieval sources, like Midrash Lekach Tov. Have you ever seen that quoted? Midrash Lekach Tov has made a comeback in sort of a yeshivish settings. It's good if you want like a nice vart for the Shabbos tables. Midrash Lekach Tov, I think, has been translated into English. Those are medieval. Those are medieval midrashim are compiled by people who identify as characters in the medieval period. This is actually an Eretz Yisrael source. So it's true, that's an excellent point. In other words, we needn't take for granted that later sources know exactly what happened in earlier sources. That's an excellent point that calls us to methodological rigor. But here, at least in terms of the reality of how far it was from the south to the north, Shir HaShirim Rabba would have known about that. But that's an excellent point. So take a look at source number three. So if it's true that we have not sort of vacationing, that's not the right word, but we don't have sort of refugees from the south, if it's not sort of the same old cast just in a new locale, but really we have a new sort of cultural context within which rabbinic Judaism is flourishing, so maybe we should expect that the institutions that they create, one of which apparently seems to be the position of Nasi, right? Because if Rabbi Yehuda Nasi is the first to hold this position, then it must wholly have been a product of the Galil. And in fact, we saw that Rabbi Yehuda Nasi's father was not Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel II, who would have been a refugee from the south. So if that's true, then maybe there should be components of the position of Nasi that are new, that we haven't seen before as part of rabbinic leadership. And if it's true that they exist, it's true that there are new components to this model of rabbinic leadership that Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi initiates. So what might those traits be? So take a look at source number three. In source number three, we have one example of something that appears for the first time only in sources that are either from the time of Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi or later, every single one, and that is the claim that the Nasi, the patriarch, descends from the house of King David. The claim that the leader of the Jewish people, the political leader of the Jewish people, descends from David HaMelech is a claim that first appears in sources that are from the time of Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi and onward. Here's one example. Amar Rabbi Levi, Megillas Yochsin, Matzu B'Yerushalayim, V'kosov Ba, Hilo Min David, Ben Yatzav Min Asaf, Ben Tzitzakeses Min Avner, Ben Kuvisin Min Achav, Ben Kalbasavua Min Kalev, Rabbi Yanai, Mindale, that should be Mindale Bavel, I think. Rabbi Yana Mindaeli, the next one that I left out is Mindabavel. Rabbi Chia Rabba Mibnei Shvacha Ben Avital. Rabbi Yossi Rabbi Chalafta Mibnei Yonadav Ben Rechav. And Rabbi Nechemya, Mibnechemya HaTirshata. Okay. Rabbi Levi, who is a figure that of course appears a generation or two after Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, claims to have found a scroll of documenting people's lineage that was buried in Yerushalayim. And in that scroll is written the following. Hillel descends from David. Now remember, Hillel, if Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi was truly related to Rabbi Gamliel, which is a claim that appears shortly after the time of Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi. So if he was truly related to Rabbi Gamliel, then the assumption would have been that he was related to Hillel of Beis Hillel fame as well. So here the claim is that Hillel descends from King David. So if Hillel descends from King David, then so does the Nasi. And then it lists a bunch of other people who are also descended from biblical characters. Now, the reason I raise this source is, first of all, just to give you a context in which this claim for the Nasi's family to descend from King David appears, but also to note that there's something peculiar about this list, which is that every single figure on this list... let's see if we can identify. Does anyone recognize anyone on this list?
Hillel.
So Hillel we recognize. He's the most famous one. Does anyone remember? The people who are being given an ancestry here. In other words, we recognize people like Nehemia, like Ezra and Nehemia. Kalbasavua. Who is Kalbasavua?
Wasn't that person?
Oh, right. But that's. I think you're thinking of Kamsa Bar Kamsa. Ah, yes, you're right. So in other words, Ben Kabbal Savua. Ben Kabbal was a wealthy man, would host events.
The dirt was really, he had something to bring to like Rome or something, and it was stolen, and then they put dirt in the bag, and then he got there, and he said the dirt.
So I believe, if I'm not mistaken, that's Nachum Ish Gamzu. Okay. If I'm not mistaken, but you are correct. But the association is correct. He is someone who was involved in politics. Correct, absolutely correct.
Ben Kabbal Savua, the rich person who dedicated something in the shul or something.
So Kabbal Savua is a wealthy sort of philanthropist. But whose father-in-law is he supposed to be? I believe it's the Bavli. Yes, excellent. I believe it's the Bavli who first makes this claim, but it may also be in the Yerushalmi. But in any event, just whether or not the Bavli is the first to make that claim, Kabbal Savua would have been the generation before Rabbi Akiva, right? So he would have been just before, let's say, the Bar Kokhba revolt.
And in the end, he did support Rabbi Akiva.
Right. So in the Bavli, he sort of reconciles. Right. He sort of reconciles with his daughter. And so forth. How about people like Rabbi Chiya Rabba? Who is Rabbi Chiya? Does anyone know who Rabbi Chiya? He appears in the Bavli, appears in the Yerushalmi. Rabbi Chiya was. Does anyone know to whom he was related? If I'm not mistaken, Rabbi Chiya was
the brother-in-law. Of,
I believe the brother-in-law or their nephew. I can't remember why I'm blanking.
Was he excommunicated because of the oven?
No, Rabbi Chiya, but good thing that is Rabbi Elazar ben Hyrcanus, if I'm not mistaken.
Okay, he was a brother-in-law then.
Right, so
one of the people
excommunicated. Right. So Rabbi Chiya, I believe, has a personal relationship in the I'm trying to remember what the Yerushalmi says about him. I believe he has a personal relationship to Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, but nonetheless, Rabbi Chiya is a student of Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi. Right. So in terms of the chronological bound. Of people that we have here. So whether or not that we recognize the names is less important than the fact of when they lived. This list, other than Hillel, documents people from as early as, let's say, fighters in the two revolts against Rome. So sort of the first century, the late first century, the Common Era, and the second century, as late as people who come shortly after Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi. So it's about, the range is about, let's say, 200 years. If you add Hillel onto the list, now all of a sudden he is, by at least 100 years, the earliest person on this list. So it's possible that Hillel was certainly related to David HaMelech. I don't know if we can tell either way, but it is telling that the one person who doesn't seem to belong in this list, because it's just far too early, is Hillel HaZaken. So,
do you think they really want to just create legitimacy?
So in other words, Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, in other words, did he want to claim sort of to be part of, right, to be part of, so it's, I think the argument could be made that Jewish leaders saw themselves in continuity with David HaMelech, whether they saw that in, whether they believed that in a genetic sense, or whether they wanted to imply that in a genetic sense, or whether they just saw it as a matter of sort of intellectual descent or political descent is unclear, but the point of the matter is that the Nasi sees, or rather the institution of the Nasi is portrayed as a major political force, such that it can be connected.
It's dynastic.
Yeah, it's dynastic. Right, that's an important point as well. It is also dynastic, right? The position of Nasi is handed down father to son, whereas the position, let's say, of rabbi is not. It can be, but it needn't be. So what's interesting here is that we have this claim to a position of leadership that is explicitly dynastic, monarchic, and political. That we haven't seen before earlier in rabbinic sources. And I want to call attention to source number 4, because source number 4 is a little bit more concrete. Source number 4 starts off innocuously. It tells us the following. Rav Shimon Chalfusa, Havayalif, Salik, Shal B'Shlami D'Rebi, B'chol Reish Yerach V'Yerach. Rav Shimon Chalfusa was accustomed to go and seek the welfare of Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi at the beginning of every month. Now, what does this mean? Why would Rabbi Shimon ben Chalfusa go to seek the welfare of Rabbi at the beginning of every month? Why would he do this? So take a look at the source to the right. This is one possible interpretation of this, and I'm going to we're going to argue based on the third source that it is the only interpretation. But one interpretation, well, let's think. Before we go outside of Rabbinic Judaism for a source for this, so if we had to stay within the confines of Rabbinic Judaism, why might Rosh Shimon Chalfusa go visit Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi? Ah, excellent. Sally knows the Bavli, right? The Gemara tells us you're supposed to go visit your Rebbe on certain occasions, right? So the sort of intra-rabbinic explanation would be he's just paying honor to his teacher, which is certainly a rabbinic value, right? Why would we expect anything else? Right? So this is not part of any relationship other than teacher and student. Now take a look at the source to the right. The source to the right is from Suetonius, a historian who compiles sort of an increasingly, as time goes by, more accurate, but all sort of highly colorful portraits of some of the Caesars that preceded him. And what he writes about Vespasian, is as follows. He writes that Vespasian was the first of the Flavian emperors. He was the general who first led the attack against the Jewish forces defending the temple, who revolted against Rome in the first century of the Common Era. So this is what he says about Vespasian. And Vespasian was a long line of emperors after this to engage in this practice and formalize it. This was in general his manner of life. While emperor, he always rose very early, in fact before daylight. Then, after reading his letters and the reports of all the officials, he admitted his friends, and while he was receiving their greetings, he put on his own shoes and dressed himself. Okay, this is called, in Latin, the salutatio. This is an institution that becomes a big deal over the course of decades, and that is that the...
It mutates in Versailles.
Absolutely, right. So this becomes sort of a paying homage to the ruler, right? What you would do is if you were a client of the emperor and he was your patron, sort of he was the power relationship between you was such that he was in charge and you were sort of an underling. So the proper practice came to be when you were relating to your overlord, you would go and say hi to them formally, as a formal occasion, every now and then, or every day of a regular schedule. So, Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi here has a student come visit him at a certain time every single month, just to be shal b'shlami, not to talk Torah with him, just to say hi. This sounds like the salutatio, but it doesn't have to be that way. Why? Because as we said, it's very possible to explain this along intra-rabbinic lines. That's what you do when you go say hi to your Rebbe. You go say hi to your teacher. The source below that, I think, however, forces us to adopt the Salatatio interpretation. And that is, this is based on a Gemara in Yerushalmi and Shabbos. It's one of my favorite Yerushalmis. He said, the Gemara tells us as follows. Elaine de Rabbi Hoshaya ud Barpazi, Havan Shalin b'shlami denasi b'chol yom. V'havan Elaine de Rabbi Hoshaya, Alan Kadmai, V'nafkin Kadmai, Azan Elaine de Barpazi, V'ischanos b'nasi Yusa, Asan Bayan Me'al Kadmai. So without getting into what happened in the rest of the Gemara, the Yerushalmi tells us as follows. The family of Rabbi Hoshaya, a major figure in rabbinic history, and the family of Barpazi, they would come and greet the Nasi every single day. The Nasi in this period is no longer Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi. It is, if you take a look at the chart, see the relationship, it is Rabbi Yehuda II Nasiya. So Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi's grandson. Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi II was a rabbinic figure in his own right, nowhere near as well known as his father. And more importantly, he was while a giant of Torah, no doubt, he was not on the because so few were. He was certainly not as respected or well known as his father. And in fact, he was not the teacher. We know of, I don't think, any people who were formerly his disciples, who were formerly his tamidim. And in this case, what would happen? You would have families you have major families who don't seem to have any sort of teacher-student relationship with this particular person, Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi II. They would go greet him every single day. And then what happened? So the family of Rabbi Hoshaya would go in first, the family of Barpazi would go in second. Ah, but then what happened? The family of Barpazi had somebody make a shidduch with someone from the Nasi's family, so now they figured, ah, we're in-laws, we're mishpacha, now we get to go in first. Right? And then the Gemara tells us about the family politics that ensued, and how the order was either altered or changed. But in any event, what we see here is an example, again, of people going to greet the Nasi, even the family of Rabbi Hoshaya. Rabbi Hoshaya was at least from the perspective of history, in Psak Halacha, Rabbi Hoshaya is a much more important figure in the history of Chazal than Rabbi Yehuda Nasiya, Rabbi Yehuda Nasi II, even though they're both, of course, giants, but there doesn't seem to have been any student-teacher relationship here. They're going to greet the family of the Nasi, they're going to greet the Nasi, the patriarch, every single day, because it seems that's what you did to aristocrats in the Middle Roman period. Okay, so here's another element of sort of aristocracy that's been imported into rabbinic leadership. Aristocracy not in a pejorative sense, but sort of in a formal sense. Rabbinic leadership has been formalized here. But whereas earlier we saw that the trappings of rabbinic leadership were augmented by drawing from within the Jewish tradition, by associating the Nasi with the family of Jewish political leadership par excellence, King David, here Jewish leadership is augmented by reference to something outside of rabbinic tradition, namely the Salatatio. Now finally, that brings us to source number 5. So we have to ask ourselves the following question. So far, we have demonstrated that Jewish rabbinic life, or sort of the Jewish revival in the wake of the Bar Kokhba revolt, takes place, not just takes place in the Galil, but is a native product of the Galil. It's not as if sort of everything was happening in the south and now we just transported it very conveniently to the north. There's sort of a new game in town, and it's in the north, in the Galil. We further demonstrated that the Galil produced a form of rabbinic leadership, namely the office of the patriarch, of the Nasi, that is different than any institution of rabbinic leadership that we've seen before, in that it incorporates all these political trappings. For example, it draws a connection to the house of King David, and it imports, and we could multiply this example a couple of times, it imports institutions from outside of rabbinic leadership, from the world of secular political leadership, and makes those part of rabbinic leadership, and it formalizes them to the point where in the Bavli, it's taken for granted as part of the student-teacher relationship. The student-teacher relationship sort of absorbs this idea of greeting your Rebbe. So that becomes part and parcel of halachic Jewish leadership. And I think these tendencies were already latent in the halacha, the idea of honor being owed to your teacher, and halacha sort of capitalizes on this development. Okay. Now, if that's the case, so we have to ask ourselves, okay, we know where rabbinic leadership was, we know where it was produced, and we know what it produced. But how did the Judaism of the Galil produce the institution of Nasi? We know where it happened, we know what happened, but we don't know how it happened or why it happened. In other words, where did this institution come from? Where did Nasi come from? Is it just something that some Rabbi Yehuda Nasi woke up one morning and decided, I'm going to drop out of law school, I'm going to go be a Nasi? So what happened?
Wasn't the Nasi the head of the
Sheva? Excellent.
The head of the Sheva.
Right, so Sally's already thinking along the right lines. Where else do we find the appearance of the term Nasi? So one of them, we know, the Nasi was the head, was sort of a tribal leader in the Torah. Now, what sort of associations would that have? In other words, Midrashim will characterize those people as scholars, as is the wont of the Midrash. But at least on a Pshuto Shomikra level, right, in terms of the simple understanding of the verses, so what were the leaders of the tribes? What sort of leaders? They're right, they were elders. So in other words, they were political leaders. Or they were tribal leaders, but in other words, tribal doesn't do so much intellectual heavy lifting for us. They were political leaders. They may also have been religious figures. That's probably the case. But they were primarily political leaders. That was their role. Who ends up using the term? Now, the term Nasi appears in Yechezkel with other connotations, other than political leadership, other than political necessarily connotations. And that ends up being co-opted by a major figure of this period, which we saw a couple semesters ago. I don't expect anybody to remember it. But who uses the title Nasi on his coins, in letters?
Bar Kokhba,
excellent. Bar Kokhba uses the title Nasi. In fact, we have coins that were minted by Bar Kokhba and by Bar Kokhba's administration itself that apply the title Nasi to Bar Kokhba. Letters where he takes the title Nasi. There, the title Nasi may have messianic implications, but mostly it has like military implications. He's a general. Now, in between Bar Kokhba and this, Nasi seems to fall out of use, right? Perhaps we don't have it until Rabbi Yehuda Nasi. But Sally's thinking the right way. Where else do we find the term Nasi? And is it possible to find the Nasi, or the institution called Nasi, is it possible to find it elsewhere in the Galil that can help us determine where it came from? So take a look at source number 5. Source number 5 is fascinating. Source number 5 tells us, Hareni alecha v'at alai shneyim asurim. Vasur medavar shalosa ir. The ezu davar shalosa ir. Go on arachava v'amercha to besknesses v'ateva v'asfarim. I am to you, and you are to me, a cherem. So in other words, if a person says, I can't get any benefit from things that you own, and you can't get any benefit from things that I own, so this is binding. And what happens? Both of those people are prohibited to make use of, let's say, municipal properties. Why? Because the lumdus behind this is, or the theory behind this is, that or at least potentially, that everybody in the city owns or has an ownership stake in municipal property, and therefore, for me to now make use of, let's say, the public bathhouse, I would be using something that belongs to you, and we just said that we can't use each other's stuff. Okay, so you can't use municipal properties. However, v'hakosev chelko lanasi, Rabbi Yehuda Omer, so rather, v'hakosev chelko lanasi, if a person signs over all of his property to the nasi, then you can both make use of this municipal property, because neither of you own it now, the nasi owns it. Rabbi Yehuda Omer, ein anshi galil tzrich lichtov, shekvar kasu avosehem al yedehen. Rabbi Yehuda says, the people of the Galil don't need to formally sign over, in other words, even if they make a vow of this sort, they don't need to formally sign over their property to the Nasi, because in Galilee, in the north, the Nasi has sort of been in charge of everything from the get-go. Now, what does this Mishnah tell us about the institution of Nasi? So who is the Nasi here? Sounds like some sort of civil official, right? It could be. In other words, now, we could posit that this is, this is the Nasi, this is the patriarch. Possible that this is the patriarch. This source predates Rabbi Yehuda Nasi. Maybe this is our smoking gun, right, the patriarch. But nobody is named here. It doesn't sound like it's a rabbinic figure per se. And in fact, the Rishonim don't read it this way. Take a look below this. The Meiri, one of the great medieval commentators, writes, V'hakosev chalko lanasi, Ritzon Alomar Hamelech O Moshel Ha'ir. The Nasi here is being read exactly the way Mrs. Falk read it, which is to say the Nasi here is a mayor. Right? The Nasi is sort of the governor, the civil, secular governor of the towns in the Galil. And in the Galil, they were particularly powerful. So these are sort of local civil aristocrats. So on this reading, the Nasi seems to be, in other words, would there only be one Nasi in this system? No, there would be several.
But each town could have a mayor, and then there's like a governor, you know, overseeing all of the municipality.
Right, so maybe there really is one, right, every town has sort of a low...
That person now communicates with Rome. I mean, the question that you
excellent,
have
excellent.
To discuss is, what is the institution, and how does it, you know, you need somebody to talk to the local government.
Excellent, excellent. So in other words, Dr. Schwartzbaum is raising the possibility that maybe the Nasi here is a singular figure, and he's sort of the political liaison. In other words, there are lower-level figures in each city, but there's one Nasi. And that Nasi has the sort of the role that we've been attributing to let's say, Rabbi Yehuda Nasi, that Origen, in his letter to Africanus, attributes to whoever the patriarch was in his day. So take a look at the next source, the Mishnah in Tanis. The very beginning of the second chapter of the Mishnah in Tanis tells us, Seda ta'anios ketzad, motzina sateva l'rachovo shalir, v'nosin efer mukla agabe ateva, u'brosha nasi, brosha abbasin, v'chol echad v'echad nosin berosha. So we're dealing with a situation in which rain has not fallen in Eretz Yisrael for a very long time, to the point where now a whole chain of fasting is set off. Now the last set of 7 fasts that the Jewish people are obligated to engage in at a time like this, proceed as follows. You remove the ark to the public square, and you put burnt ashes upon it. Then you put it up, then you put the ashes upon the head of the Nasi, then upon the head of the court, and then each person present puts ashes on him or herself. These fasts, according to the Mishnah, take place in every town. Now I ask you, if there's only one Nasi, so what has to happen? The Nasi has to travel to every single town. And moreover, if there's only one Sanhedrin, right? Last time we entertained the possibility that there's still a Sanhedrin in this period, which we saw there's no evidence for. But this source, if it's referring to the Nasi, like Rabbi Yehuda Nasi, and the head of the Sanhedrin, so they have to travel around to every single city in Israel during these fasts in order for this Mishnah to describe accurately what's going on. Yeah, it's impossible. It's not possible. So it must be what we're talking about here are local people, are people who are local. So every town would have to have a Nasi. It would be the same Nasi that we just discussed in the previous source when you sign over all of your property to that official. It seems to be a local level official, a person who is sort of a local civil governor. And in fact, if you take a look to the right of this, we can actually read in our own time because we're running out of time. The source to the right of that shows that that in fact in the Chivas HaGaonim, when the Gaonim cite this Mishnah, it refers to Nasi in the plural, Nasiim. Right, so we know that the Gaonim are interpreting this to refer not to the Nasi, but to a group of people who are each have the title Nasi. Now, where this leaves us, I think, is as follows. At least in a historical sense, Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, what seems to have occurred is that Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi seems to have been the product, or maybe the initiator, of a movement to adapt local leadership into a rabbinic mold. To take people who are already leading the people and model the leadership that rabbinic Judaism saw itself as exercising over the Jewish people, model it on that sort of basic framework, and then add or augment it with various features, some from the biblical period and some from the contemporary Roman period. That seems to be where Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi emerges from. Judaism emerges in the Galil in the wake of the Bar Kochba revolt, and in putting forth this grand vision of rabbinic leadership, it sort of adapts an already existing local model and superimposes upon it the values of Chazal, and of the Masorah, of the tradition, and so on and so forth. Now, what does this mean to us? Why do we care about this? It's fascinating to me that the grand project of rabbinic leadership, when Chazal reinvent themselves, not just as a group of students and teachers teaching each other, although of course that's vital, that was how the Masorah was preserved, but as a political force that leads the Jewish people, not just within the halls of the study hall, not just within the four walls of the Beis Medrash, but everywhere, in a holistic sense. In the capital in Rome, throughout the land of Israel, when Chazal reimagined the project of Jewish leadership, they do so not by simply asserting that however the rabbis were leading themselves, that was going to suffice for the Jewish people. We're just going to expand our role outward. That was not how Chazal imagined themselves. It wasn't like they took the Rosh Yeshiva and now made him Rosh Yeshiva not just for Chazal, but made him Rosh Yeshiva for all of Klal Yisrael. That wasn't what happened. What Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi represents is the incredible nimbleness of Chazal, their creative dynamic, their dynamism, that allowed them to think, if we truly are going to lead our people in the wake of a national catastrophe, how are we going to do so? By adapting our core values, Talmud Torah, the study of Torah, the preservation of Jewish values, and augment it with the best of what we find in the society that we're trying to lead. So Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi is, on the one hand, sort of the conservative, the conservator par excellence. Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi represents to us the spirit of preservation. He edits the Mishnah. He takes all of what is best in our tradition, and he distills it into this one magnificent work that forms the basis of Jewish law. And moreover, when he adds a political dimension to his leadership, He draws from the best of our tradition of political leadership, the reign of King David, David HaMelech Alav HaShalom himself. And yet, Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi is also a daring forward thinker, one who realizes that Jewish leadership needs to adapt to the best standards.
Have contact with the other.
Have contact with the other. He adds the Salutatio. He adapts the basic leadership structure, including, it seems, the title of Nasi, from the surrounding civil leadership that was working quite effectively. So much so that it's integrated into Mishneig, into Chazal's rituals, how fasts are conducted. So Yehuda HaNasi, in this sense, is, I think, modeling for us how rabbinic leadership needs to proceed, which is to say that it needs to be, on the one hand, absolutely dependent upon and loyal to the best of our tradition, and at the same time, it needs to be creative in imagining how that tradition can be applied to modern circumstances at hand. I think the best of this leadership now is probably located in the land of Israel. Just the idea of taking...
I was going to say, what are you talking about? Every politico here has to make a stop in Brooklyn.
True, you're right. You're right.
Right.
So in other words, if we're talking about just pure influence, I think right, there's nobody can match what certain communities of Jews can do here, just in terms of having politicians. Correct. But if we imagine Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi as just being excelling at accumulating power, then perhaps that would be correct. I want to
I wasn't being so disparaging.
Oh, you're right. So in other words, right. So if right, and
you said the model was transformed in Brooklyn.
Right.
I mean,
you're right. You're right. And I think in
the Rebbe tells people who to vote for.
I wasn't even.
No, but I think
he has been a scholar and he has contact in the political.
Right. So I think
also political.
Absolutely.
But doesn't acquiesce like that other nations will follow, you know, but is very political and very
absolutely
involved in politics.
Absolutely. And I think Mrs. Falk is correct in a very important sense, which is to say political power should not be sort of sneered at, right?
No, I'm just saying they recognize the need, even as similar as they are, they recognize
absolutely
the need.
Absolutely.
And they don't want to leave it to the general public. You know?
Absolutely. And I think I think this is then a good coda to my revise the coda of my remarks here, which to incorporate what Mrs. Falk is saying, which is to say, I think the type of leadership that I had imagined, and we should incorporate Mrs. Falk as well, is just the idea of taking Torah and applying it to modern challenges, whether it be in the realm of medicine, whether it be in the realm of technology, whether it be in the realm of politics, espionage, how a modern Jewish military might function. All of this work is being done in Israel because the very nature of having a Jewish state is something that I think is unique to Israel, of course. But on the other hand, I think Mrs. Falk is correct, that the idea of having a robust, vibrant, vital Jewish community that is making use of its, that it's not sort of turning up its nose at its surroundings, but is really, truly trying to make a better life for itself and for others, one hopes, by utilizing the powers that be. Yeah, I think if we're imagining the future of Jewish leadership, it should look something like this, which is to say...
I mean, they need to keep clean.
Right. Which is to say, marshaling the best of our tradition, insisting that we be a part of the political process, insisting that we make use of it, but also ensuring that our values are not just catered to, but I think serve the broader population, which is ultimately what Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi did. He took a model of Jewish leadership that was present only within the community, the sort of small community that identified with Chazal prior to then, and really expanded it. The community that adheres to the values of Chazal is not negligible at this time. It's sizable.
Every monarch throughout history has sought religious legitimacy and has sought to accrete power to themselves through basically some sort of attaching themselves to
sure.
some ancient figure. There's nothing particularly unique about what you're describing.
No, certainly.
In doing, it's what monarchs always try to do.
Certainly not. Right. There's nothing. Right. In other words, there's nothing. Right. There's nothing unique. There's nothing unique about this. That's certainly the case. What I think is unique about this, what's unique about Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, is that the model of leadership to which he lays claim is not, on the one hand, sort of
romantic.
Right? In other words, he's not like the Kohanim, let's say the priests of the Second Temple period, who are basing their claim to legitimacy and to leadership solely on their being priests. And on the other hand, he's not modeling himself on, let's say, a secular power that rises, that sort of a secular authority that rises to power and takes advantage of popular religious discontent, like, say, Cyrus, the founder of the Achaemenid Empire, who also plays a major role in Jewish history. What he does is he blends those two, I think, what is a fascinating way. He blends this impetus, this mandate for leadership that the Jewish people desperately needed in this transitional period, with this claim, well-founded claim to antiquity, to Jewish legitimacy, and so forth. So that, I think, is what is unique about the story of Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi. With that, I'll conclude. I apologize for going over time. Next time, we're going to take a break from our regularly scheduled programming. We're going to look at some Purim-related issues. In particular, we're going to take a look at some of the archaeology of how the story of Purim is depicted in shuls, in really fascinating bits of fascinating archaeological specimens that are relevant to the time period that we're discussing. So with that, I bid you a very good night.
You know, we disparage it, but in point of fact, it's the realization.